The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
If you're a nature photographer and you are thinking of transitioning to video and wildlife filmmaking, then this episode is for you. My guest this episode is Jayaprakash Bhujan. Jayaprakash is the 2017 National Geographic Nature Photographer of the Year, and he won that award for an image that, if you're watching this on the YouTube channel, you will see up right now. If you're not, if you're listening on the podcast, I'll describe the picture. It was of an orangutan up to its waist in water, looking out from behind a tree. And I won't talk too much about this because Jayaprakash goes into detail and I would love for you to hear it from him. But what I love about Jayaprakash's story is that he made this transition from photographer to wildlife filmmaker, and he's done it really successfully. And I know that so many of you out there are in the same position where you want to start using your gear to take pictures as well as record video and do that in a way that you could transition into actually earning a living from it, like Jayaprakash. So no more from me. Let's get on with this wonderful chat with Jayaprakash after a word from our sponsor. This podcast is proudly powered by Battleborn Batteries. Let the power of lithium take you on your journeys across the outdoor world. Battleborn Batteries is the industry's top choice for lithium-ion batteries. Reliable, safe, and long-lasting, Battleborn makes the sustainable and lightweight drop-in replacement for traditional lead-acid batteries. Are you ready to make the switch to lithium and switch to green energy? If so, all batteries are in stock now, and you can shop today at battlebornbatteries.com. Jayaprakash, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very early morning schedule. I know you're in Singapore right now. It's super early. Taking the time out to be on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jake. It's a pleasure. I mean, thank you for inviting me for your show.
Absolutely. You know, what I found really interesting, you're quite different to a lot of the guests we have on, because most of the guests are established wildlife filmmakers that we have on the show. But what really captivated me about your story is that you are you're a National Geographic Nature Photographer of the Year Award recipient of 2017, and you're now recording more video, and we'll get in talking about why you're doing that. But I really like that, because I think so many people now are doing a very similar thing. And it used to be that the gear was the barrier to entry. You know, you'd have to have a stills camera and you would have to have a video camera. And now, of course, we're in the place where you know, your stills camera or your video camera, depending on which way you want to look at it, does both. And so many people can now make that jump and switch over back and forth. But before we get into that, I would love just to hear your background, kind of what it was that got you into nature photography in the first place, however far back that was, whether it was at 2 years old or 25 years old. Let's hear all about it.
Sure. So I kind of grew up in the mountains back down south in India. At a very young age, when my father decided to, study his PhD, they left me with my grandparents when he moved to another city to actually, do his education. So I spent a large part of my childhood with my grandfather, who was one of those super rich farmers who had acres and acres of land when he was doing a huge amount of farming. In those days, there were really no reserves, like tiger reserves and all that you see in India now. There were really no demarcation that, you know, this is a reserve and this is not a reserve. So we kind of lived on the periphery of, which is now a reserve. So I just grew up in an environment where, you know, I seen tigers just walking with my grandfather into the forest, seen hundreds of elephants migrating from, which is now Kerala, down south to the other parts of Karnataka. Grew up chasing owls, chasing birds. Some of the monkey species that I remember I used to chase as a kid are almost extinct now from where I come from. So generally grew up in a place just surrounded by a lot of nature and wildlife. So I think it was kind of a natural progression for me probably to be doing what I'm doing today. But this is not how I started, though. I was with the ITS industry for almost 19 and a half years. Before I decided to quit, I said, I'm done with this. I want to do something that I really care about and I really enjoy doing. So, and then I started chasing, you know, my passion for travel and nature photography. And of course, now videography in the recent past. And things just happened. I was in Borneo one weekend because I was actually, I'm still working on a book on primates of Southeast Asia. We have some of the most endangered species of primates across Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Malaysia. So I was just traveling extensively across Southeast Asia, hoping to do like a photo book on endangered primates. And then accidentally happened to take some shots of a wild orangutan crossing a river. It went viral, and obviously, you know, I won the National Geographic Award for it because historically, orangutans have been seen in water and playing with water and stuff like that in captivity, but not really in the wild because they actually hate water. And especially these right. were waters where there were crocodiles. So I think that caught the eye of some of the judges when they were evaluating. And life kind of, it kind of put my new career on the fast track. My social media grew overnight. And you know how it is. It's loads of interviews, newspaper interviews. I was kind of all over the place. And by then I was just in Singapore, and even my Singapore Straits Times, which is a local newspaper, gave me a one full page on the newspaper. So my career took off. Sometimes they say, you know, one good image can change your life. So in my case, I think that was a perfect example how just one amazing image can make your life.
Absolutely. Then I started. And I just want to say, because I have the picture over on my other computer here, and I'll put the image up on the thumbnail so people will have seen it, you know, and I'm sure be familiar with it. It's so amazing because just looking into that orangutan's eyes, it and the way that it's holding the tree, that emotion that it seems to ooze, you know, from its predicament that it's in and being seen in that way, it's stunning. And it's the old adage, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. It really is. And it shows you, like, you know, he's been caught in this predicament, this dangerous situation. And so I can totally see why it won. And I think it's amazing. I love the fact that you weren't out there to take an image to win an award. Because I think this is something where, certainly in filmmaking, a lot of people make films to try and win awards, you know, and it's such the wrong path to go down. You know, you were there for other reasons. You were trying to get pictures for a book, and it just happened to turn into this. And, you know, I love those stories because it shows, you know, you had a passion to be out there in the first place. You weren't just out there trying to get a picture to win an award, and you just were lucky to get this shot. And you took a whole bunch of shots with this one. Did you stay with the orangutan as it crossed the river and came back again? How long were you there?
Well, I was there on the Sekenai River trying to photograph proboscis monkeys swimming across the water. because that's a photograph I'd imagined in my mind for my book, because they're amazing swimmers, and sometimes I've seen them swimming with the babies on their back, like an entire group. So one morning I meet one of these rangers who frequently I used to talk to, and I was living on a houseboat on the river because there's really not many places to stay. Invited him over for coffee, and I was just talking to him, and I said, "Have you seen any proboscis group around this area?" And then just out of nowhere, he says, "It's a long time since I've seen proboscis monkeys swimming across the river, but last week I saw an orangutan in a river." That's how it happened. And I had goosebumps because I'd done enough research to know that it's really rare to see an orangutan literally, crossing a river. He gave us some vague directions. It was quite far away, almost 50 kilometers by road, equal to 50 kilometers by road, but we were on the sea. So I asked my guy if it's possible to get there. So then we called for a speedboat, a four-seater speedboat. And then we took the speedboat to this, obviously in the river, it's hard for people to give you exact location. So we had like a fair idea where it happened. And then it was 3 days of waiting on a four-seater speedboat. And then finally, one day before I had to leave is when all of this just unfolded. I was just blessed to be there at the right time at the right place.
That's fantastic. The 11th hour. I talk about that a lot. It always seems to be the 11th hour that things happen. The amount of times we've been on shoots and you have nothing up until the last day.
Well, absolutely. Everything. Absolutely. Well, people ask me all fantastic. The time. Yeah. I mean, I think in a recent interview, somebody was asking me, because, video's a little more tricky, right? I mean, maybe you come to it later. Sometimes if I spend 100 hours, my actual filming hours may be like 20 minutes,
Yeah, because you're waiting around.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that people think all wildlife filmmaking is just waiting for months on end until you film, 10 seconds of action. And of course, it's not all like that. It may be with certain species in certain parts of the world. There's different types of filming. But it's incredible how, I mean, one of our shoots, we were out and to film the sardine run, and we filmed pretty much nothing in the first 4 days. We only had 5 days out there, and we ended up filming the whole show on the last day, 45 minute show for National Geo. Well, actually it wasn't for Nat Geo, but it was subsequently shown on there, but the whole show was filmed on the last day. And, that is just how it goes sometimes. But Jayaprakash, let's go back to that moment where you decided to give up your career and move into wildlife photography. How much of a strain? There's a lot of people in that situation, a lot of people who have taken the road of security. They wanted to be a photographer. They wanted to be a filmmaker. But they needed to pay the bills. And, it can be a slow climb to get a career based in wildlife filmmaking or photography. What was that moment like when you decided enough is enough? Had you saved up and you were in a place where you could now, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give it so long. Or, what was your kind of plan as you set to take on the role as this new career of a nature photographer?
Well, this is probably one of... most frequently asked questions, especially when I have my talks in schools and colleges. A lot of youngsters, want to become filmmakers, photographers. But honestly, in my case, it was a little different because I was a lot more financially secure because I was in a very senior position in the IT/ITS industry. I'd spent 20 years doing that. While I continued to do photography as a hobby, though, it was not like I just randomly did that. Every opportunity, every weekend I was filming. A large part of my second half of my career, I was doing a global role, so I was working from home. So I had access to my early mornings and late evenings. There were some lakes nearby. I was kind of addicted. So every morning, 4:35, I would be there in the lake just photographing. So it was a, it was a process. It was something that was playing in my mind for quite a while. But at the same time, it was not an easy decision because especially when you're used to established workplace, you know what your monthly income is going to be like. Life is a lot more planned, and all of a sudden you entering a fresh career, almost like a newbie, because you've not done that full time before. So I wouldn't say it was easy, but a little bit of pressure on myself. But I said I'm going to give it maybe 2 or 3 years and see how it goes. And if it really doesn't work out, then maybe, you know, I get back to what I was doing. But then for me, I was very sure that I wanted to take this chance, irrespective of what happens. But I think it's important. So I would say do this only if you're really crazy about what you want to do. Because I feel like a lot of people, especially a lot of youngsters, think it's a really cool job because one day they see my Instagram page and say, oh, this guy is in Africa one day, next day he's in Japan, next day he's... So in fact, I stopped posting pictures of myself from these locations because I was feeling I was kind of sending the wrong message to the youngsters because...
Interesting.
It's because these days there's so much of marketing happening, right? People like to post with all the big cameras, 600mm lenses and stuff like that. Sometimes I think it kind of gives a wrong message to especially young people. I feel a lot of people on my social media or Instagram pages messaging me disappointed because just out of school or college, you really can't afford all this stuff. Impossible, right? We're talking about 30-40K worth high-end equipment. But at the same time, all these people are very, very passionate. And I don't think there are many people out there who are giving guidance or directions to these people. So I often tell them, you know, wildlife filmmaking or photography is not about expensive equipment or long lenses. One of my favorite lines is, you know, there's a different subject for every focal length you have. Okay, you only have a 50mm lens. Why are you chasing birds, right?
Yeah.
Go chase something. There are different subjects, you know. So depending on the focal length of your lens, you can actually create very interesting stories of you know, different subjects. Because I think in the hobbies world, especially newcomers, a lot of people think you know, like cats, big cats, or lions, or birds in flight seem to be you know, the best part of it, but there's more to it. For my favorite species of mudskippers, I spend hours just lying in the mud flats just to you know, film mudskippers. So I think there's more to it. Like I said, you make the career change if it really means something to you, and if you're really, really crazy about it, that it kind of like pushes you to the limit to excel if you really want to do well in this industry. Because again, like, I mean, you're a master coach, so not an easy industry to even break into because it's quite competitive and there are a lot of people out there doing amazing work. So
and that's one of the things about social media is, of course, we see this amazing work. And if we compare ourselves constantly and consistently with that work, we start to feel like our work isn't good enough. And I think it's amazing that you decided to stop posting. I think that's fantastic because social media is something that has just, it's got away with us completely. I mean, we're in a place where, you know, it's all about wowing with the next picture, wowing with the next post. How beautiful does your, you know, your feed look? And of course, you know, we all, even someone like myself being in the industry, I see pictures on there. I go, wow, these images are stunning. How could I ever take a picture to compare with that, you know? But as you and I both know, it's not necessarily, I mean, there is the fundamentals of taking a photo, but what your photo had in it was, as well as being a great photo, you know, technically, it had that you know, we would, in the filming world, with, we're always trying to capture behavior. Well, in this, you captured a moment that just it has an explanation that comes with the very moment of seeing it. You understand that orangutan is not in a happy place, and And it's those moments, and I think probably if that moment had even been caught on a phone, you know, it would be as worth, you know,
absolutely,
you know, as much as it is being caught on a professional camera, because it's what the picture says, not what it was taken on. And so I admire you for doing that, for taking, you know, the stance on not posting, because this is a huge problem I see with youngsters, especially because now, you know, you and I no doubt grow up in a world where we just had, you know, we had goals and we worked and worked and worked along to get to them. We didn't have these constant things popping up in our life telling us we had to be better, or telling us that we weren't good enough, or trying to make us compare. You know, now with social media, there's a comparison, constant comparison every day, and people don't feel worthy. And also they don't see that you have put in decades of work to get to a point to win an award like that, you know, or to own a $40,000 worth of camera gear, because I'm sure you didn't have that when you started out.
No, I couldn't afford them.
Exactly. And so we all start in the same place. There's very few people who start with the right gear. And, you know, the people who do don't actually really know what to do with it. So because they've not gone through those experiences. So I admire you for that. I think that's fantastic. I think what I would love to, and I'm sure the listeners really want to know as well, when was it that you decided that you were going to start clicking over to the video icon on your stills camera? When was it you decided, okay, I'm going to try some video?
Well, I think like you were just talking about, I think when I started, it was all about trying to take beautiful pictures. But then I realized at some point, every day I see brilliant images on Instagram or Facebook and all the social media pages. But then I started thinking, you know, how many of those images I remember, or how many of those moments that I remember that I've seen in the last few weeks, and I can't seem to remember many. So I'm assuming it's the same with many people. So I started thinking, you know, how can my pictures make a difference? So I think at some point I started thinking, I directionally wanted to move away from just making beautiful images to telling stories. So then I started thinking there are limitations to the kind of stories I can say with photography. I mean, you still can, though it's a very powerful medium, but there are limitations. So I said, how can I do you know, longer stories, complete stories, better stories? So I think that's when I switched to videos. But at the same time, this whole COVID situation has been a blessing in disguise for me, because most of my work was overseas, across Borneo and Japan and some projects in Africa. But when COVID happened, all my projects were on hold. So now I said, you know, what do I do? I'm living in Singapore. It's a nature, we call it a nature and city, it used to be called a city in a garden. Now it's we're focusing on city in nature. Though I've lived here for about 6.5 years, I never really explored my own backyard because I was mostly working overseas. Singapore was like a hub for me. So I said, why not? So then I went up and I looked at what work has been done in terms of whatever little bit of nature and wildlife is there in the country. So I had two choices, just go around taking pictures in Singapore and, you know, like sharing on, like you said, Instagram or Facebook, or do something for meaningful, something more substantial, something that I could wow people with, or something that people can appreciate. So I started thinking, and then, I started off with a recce, started frequenting some of these reserves here, started studying the habitat. Started making a list of some of the species that is there, and obviously storytelling with videos a lot more difficult as well, because it's a time consuming process. And then I realized there was a park just 5 minutes away from where I live. We had a few family of owls. We had a reasonably good amount of raptors, and it was a very It's a very tiny place. I mean, half the size of a football ground, maybe. That's it.
Wow.
The entire space. But then it was a nice triangle because we had the oceans, we had a small patch of mangroves and forested patches. So it was a nice triangle, and you know, the biodiversity was just interesting. Kingfishers, because of the mangroves, we had a lot of you know, birds coming in. Because of the forested patches, we have goshawks and hawk eagles and honey buzzards and all of them coming. And interestingly, Singapore kind of falls on the migration path. So during winter season, I noticed a lot of migratory birds kind of do like a pit stop, you know, for sometimes a week or 2 weeks before they continue towards Borneo and other parts of India and Asia. So that was another interesting period for me. So yeah, it started off as just a fun project to kill time, and then somebody in WWF and our national park here in Singapore happened to see the video, and I think in the first week we had about 100,000 hits on the YouTube. So a lot of people were like
Wow.
shocked, saying one of the most familiar comments was, "I can't believe this is Singapore." So that was like a win-win for me because that was the outcome I was looking for, because I felt a lot of Singaporeans themselves did not know what they had here in Singapore. And I felt more and more people in Singapore need to appreciate what we have, because we have some, I think we have some incredibly beautiful parks. I mean, they're not large in size because we are a tiny island. But just the design, and there's a lot of work gone in by national parks and stuff like that. So, though we don't have huge mammals like tigers and stuff like that, I mean, we have civet cats, we have pangolins, we have leopard cats, collar goose, flying lemurs, loads. So it was interesting because a lot of people who Singaporeans who lived here all their life had not seen some of the species that I put out in the video. So it
That's
kind of went
amazing.
viral, yeah. So it kind of again went viral, and then that kind of gave me motivation to do more. You know, I said, okay, it makes sense. I think it's a good opportunity to educate people locally over here in terms of the amazing biodiversity we have. WWF is interested because they saw the video. They said, "Hey, why don't we get together and do your next video?" I said, "Great. If you guys, you know, willing to pay for it, I'm happy to." So they funded my next video, which was a focus more on Singapore and not just one park. So we went around filming all across the country. We did a lot of night filming, and it was a slow process because it was just the two of us, no big crew, just me and my partner. We went around collecting a lot of footage because I was mostly looking for behavioral kind of footage. So yeah, I mean, that's how it happened. And then from there, I started doing more and more videos. Started people from the local universities, from the film schools, because there are not many people who do nature videos here in Singapore. While there are a lot of people who do a lot of other commercial work. So I think it was kind of new for a lot of people. So I started doing a lot of talks, small sessions. I kind of do mangrove walks sometimes, you know, take kids out from schools just to show them around the mangroves. Yeah, it's been a
That's
very interesting 2, 3 years.
it's wonderful because I think I think a lot of people would think, what is there to, I mean, I hear this all the time, in fact, what is there to film now? Everything's been filmed, National Geographic, BBC, PBS Nature, Smith, you name it, all species have been on there. There's just nothing to film anymore. So how could I ever make a film to compete? And yet here you are in the middle of the pandemic, which is we're just coming out of, and you were able to go out, film something because you wanted to for yourself. WWF sees it, and now you're working with them, working on filming wildlife for them. And that's amazing because it just shows the kinds of opportunities out there that, you know, those opportunities still exist. You know, you can still be taken up and recognized and start getting paid work for doing this stuff. But you have to be out there doing it in the first place. You know, I think that, you know, that's the thing we have to, you know, I drill into people all the time when people say to me, well, how do I get into this business? I'm really interested in being a wildlife filmmaker. And I say, well, what have you filmed? And they say, well, I haven't done anything yet because, you know, I don't see the opportunity. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I said start building a portfolio. You have time on your hands. You have some reasonably good equipment. I mean, just start shooting. I mean, it's because a lot of people ask me, how did you get this footage? Or how did you get this shot? How did you get this? So sometimes it's hard to explain this because, for example, I have a small, I think, 20-second clips where there are these two mudskippers, you know, kind of going at each other and fighting. It took me 3 months just to get that 10 seconds because, you know, I'm there every day, you know, just lying down, coming back home, completely drenched in mud, and because I was filming in an urban place, and it's not like wild like in Africa or India, a lot of humans around. So sometimes I'm lying there just waiting for something to happen and getting closer and closer to some of the mudskippers, and somebody would just walk up to me and say, "Hey JP, what are you doing?" And all the mudskippers just disappear. You know, I'm like, Jesus, I spent last 2 hours lying down over here. I mean, fair enough, right? I mean, it's hard to explain.
You need a big sign. You need to carry a sign around saying "Filming in progress."
So I
love that because I think you'll become known as the mudskipper guy. You know, it's one of those things where when you pick a species, you do kind of get known for it. You know, one of the things I'm known for is filming urban bears, you know, black bears in urban environments, because I do so much of it. Once you become known for filming a particular species, then people start seeking you out. And people start saying, well, we need, you know, we want this sequence on mudskippers. Jayaprakash in Singapore, he's out doing this all the time. They're on his Vimeo feed and his YouTube and his Instagram. And so then people start reaching out. And that has happened to me with black bears. I know it's happened to a ton of other filmmakers who specialize. Certainly people like Patrick Dykstra, who's on the podcast, who was filming orca and humpback whales, and his footage was seen and ended up being in Blue Planet. So, you know, it's one of those ways to get recognized is to make it easy on yourself and pick a species that is nearby, something you have access to, instead of thinking, well, I want to film, you know, wildebeest, but it's going to cost me 10 grand to get out there, and then I've only got a week. And, you know, pick something that's on your doorstep. How far away are you from the mudskippers?
Probably 10 minutes away.
There you go, 10 minutes. I mean, that's fantastic. So you can pretty much film mudskippers whenever you want. You just go out, you decide, you're out there filming. Yeah.
But I think that's wonderful. But I think your initial question, you said people feel like, okay, Africa, for example, a lot of my friends don't want to go to Africa anymore because they're like, especially, you know, friends who are really good at what they do and, you know, they've already built amazing portfolios of photographs. They're like, Africa's already done and dusted. People have killed it. There's nothing left to done. But like you said, I mean, my inspiration to go out every morning is because every day is a new day. And every time it's something new. I mean, that's what is beautiful about nature. No matter how much is being done, every time I see something, it could be as simple as on a new branch or on a new leaf or, you know, doing something else against a different background. I mean, it's so. Yeah, it's, for me, it's like I just can't wait to get there because I'm hoping I'm going to see something new today. That's kind of what keeps me going.
Yeah. And of course, you know, in this day and age, behavior is changing. with animals. Absolutely. We're seeing this across the world, behaviors changing, and there's certainly behaviors that are happening now with certain species that has not been seen before. And so we're at that critical time as storytellers where if we can capture that and bring that to the attention of the world and scientists and researchers, then that sparks interest. Is okay, why is this happening? What can we do to change that? That's happening more and more. The fact that filmmakers go out and it's the first time behavior's been seen, it's happening, you know, way more and helping science. And actually, going back to Patrick's new show called Chasing Ocean Giants is all about him going out and trying to film new behavior happening on, you know, with the scientists there and trying to capture stuff that's not been seen before. So, Jayaprakash, I want to go back in time to, again, where you gave up your job and you took on photography. How long did it take you to start getting paid gigs? Did you have paid gigs already lined up with nature photography, or was that something you had to work on?
Well, on and off, just small projects here and there. But in my case, I think just 2 weeks after I won the National Geographic Award, I got my first project from National Geographic Asia. Especially because I was in Singapore, I think it's really not like a hub for a lot of wildlife filming and, you know, to get a lot of wildlife-related work. So I had to expand my scope. I wasn't just doing wildlife. I was doing everything around the environment. I was doing stories on plastic. I was doing stories around recycling. I was doing stories around the environment. I was doing stories around conservation. So I think sometimes for people like us, for freelancers, it's important to be relevant to what's happening around us and, you know, not just be blind and say, this is the only thing I will do. Then it's hard to survive. Yeah. And again, there were not many people doing something like this. So I think followed by that, I got my first local gig from the government themselves on recycling, right? They were running a recycling campaign. They wanted me to do like a photo story for a moving exhibition across Singapore and what happens in Singapore with respect to this whole process end-to-end of recycling. So they took me all to the recycling facilities. We call it SEMCOP. We have a small island where we take all the trash to a little island in Singapore and where we, you know, kind of burn them. That's how we keep the country clean.
It's exceptionally clean. It's exceptionally clean. I did a tour of 20 schools giving talks with National Geographic back in 2003 and at Singapore Zoo. And it's I had been there about 15 years earlier as well on a trip through to Australia. But it always amazed me when you get out of the airport and it's so spick and span. I mean, the roads are the cleanest roads I've seen anywhere in the world. It's amazing.
Well, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of effort that goes into keeping the country clean, including a lot of education around, you know, for example, we have blue bins, green bins, what goes into the green bins, what goes into the blue bins. So it's just interesting. So that happened. I was relatively still new in Singapore. So I was very happy for Singapore to have given me kind of like a newcomer an opportunity to do something serious as this and a paid gig. Things rolled off from there, and then did a lot of paid talks, paid gigs. That's when I started working with two large NGOs. One is called Orangutan Alliance, and the other one is called Borneo Orangutan Survival. I think BOS is well known. We still have about 400 or 500 orangutans in rehab before they're being released to the wild. So I do a lot of promotion for them. I do a lot of fundraising activities for them. We did some exhibitions in places like Germany, UK, and a few other places to raise funds. In fact, this coming September, I'm back in Borneo to do a short documentary. It was my idea though, but finally they decided to fund the project on this boy who lives in the US who talks about orangutans and does a lot of education to kids on orangutans. He's one of those little baby conservationists, you know. He's only seen an orangutan in the zoo. He's never seen a wild orangutan.
Wow.
So his parents are actually bringing him to Borneo for the first time so they can show this boy a real orangutan.
Wow.
So the organization that I was working for wants to support the story. So there's a whole crew coming in from Australia. So I decided to convert this into a nice little documentary and call it, the boy's name is Jack. Jack goes to Borneo. And maybe take it to some film festivals and stuff like that, you know. Should be interesting.
Excellent. Yeah. No, that's fantastic. I love that. And you know, it's such a popular genre when you can bring in, you know, a human interacting with the wildlife, not necessarily interacting, but, you know, being inspired by wildlife and doing some good in that way. It sounds fascinating. So we'll look out for that when you get that finished. So I'm desperate for you to give some advice to people who are photographers, nature photographers, whether they're established, whether they're aspiring nature photographers, or, you know, wherever they are in their photography realm. I want, you know, just what advice do you have in terms of this kind of transitioning into the video world? You know, what do you think would work best for them to do?
Well, some people would disagree, especially people who started off with video only. But then I feel, especially if you've already been doing a lot of nature photography, transitioning into videography should be relatively easy because you're already out there shooting nature. You have a good understanding of animal behavior. You know where they come. You have a better good understanding of light. And all those aspects. So it should be, I think most people find videography a little more scary because they're worried about the post-production part of this whole
process. It still scares me.
Yeah, but I thought so too, right? I mean, I honestly avoided video for a long time because I used to look at like a Final Cut Pro or one of the softwares and, you know, look at people editing and I would say, Jesus, I'm not going to do this. This sounds, you know, crazy tough or crazy hard. But like I said, the pandemic is a blessing in disguise. I had the time. I said, why not learn to pick up a new skill? Though I don't have to do it professionally. I mean, I would typically go to a professional editor if I'm doing a full length video story for my client. But for my basic edits and stuff like that, but also that as a filmmaker, it's good to know a bit of editing because it's easy to visualize the story in your head. So, you know, you kind of know how you're going to piece these scenes together. So all that makes. So I don't think it is difficult. I think sometimes you just have to have that faith and, you know, jump into it. I would say all photographers should at least try a little bit of video and experiment with it before they decide whether that is something that they really want to do or not. Could be a decision that could take later on. But I think for most nature photographers, it should be a relatively easier transition is what I personally feel. Because I felt it was a lot easier for me because I already had like a good understanding of behavior, for example, just composition of, you know, how you want to compose a picture and all that stuff actually makes it a lot more easier for newcomers. But if you're one of those guys who's just going out to like safari kind of a photography, then filmmaking is a lot different if you want to just transition because you really need to spend time understanding the habitat where you want to film in. You can't just walk in and say, okay, today I'm going to make a short film. You're not probably going to see anything, right? Spend a lot of time. Like when I started, I used a lot more of the binoculars before I picked up the camera. So, you know, just observation. It is 90% observation, 10%. I think the technical aspects of videography is probably the easiest thing of wildlife filmmaking. Right? If you've learned maths and physics and science in school, working the camera and getting the settings right and all that stuff is child's play. But the harder part is where to find them, how they behave, what's the bird's favorite perch, what time they come, what time they go, how they behave in certain scenarios. I mean, that is 90% of it if you really want to do, you know, good stories through videos, especially with nature and wildlife. So observation. I mean, take notes. So that's the way to go. I don't know what else to say.
I couldn't agree more. It's perfect because it's so true. The everyone worries about gear from the get-go. And the gear can be learned so quickly in a crash course on YouTube videos. Wherever you want to learn about gear, you can learn about gear and understand how it works very fast. Whereas the behavioral side, understanding what an animal is going to do before it does it so that you can capture it. And then, of course, storytelling. You know, storytelling, I tell my, you know, my members of my mentoring class all the time, it's all about story. You can go and make a film with an iPhone if your story is great and you've got a great story and you can capture it, then it's, you know, it's worth showing. But without a story and without knowing how to visually tell that story and build sequences, and of course, I would think with stills, I don't do a lot of stills, never really have, but not in a big way. But there's still a certain amount of, you know, you want to take a certain amount of photos if there's behavior going on to build a sequence of images. Well, obviously with video, image sequences are everything. I mean, it's how you tell a good story is to have a sequence that shows the story unfolding. You know, it's not just a case of running out there and pressing record and, oh, I got some shots of some sandpipers, I should be good. You know, they have to do something. Like you said, you waited 3 months to get them, you know, at each other. And that's behavior. And there's a story that can be part of a bigger story.
Absolutely.
But without that, yeah. You know, I think that's great. And it's, you know, it's fantastic to hear you say that transitioning, because I think there's a lot of people who want to do that. And I think it probably they get worried about the technical side too much, as you say, because really you're just changing, you know, one switch on the camera and now you're pressing record and following stuff. Yeah. Yes, there's more to it than that.
And then honestly, these days, cameras and equipment, I mean, cameras are becoming better and better and better and better. In my, for example, I use A7S III, Sony FX3 and FS6. I mean, just incredible cameras these guys make these days. Right? Gone are those days. I recently got my first Red Komodo, so I've been just experimenting slowly with the Red. So it's more about visualizing the story you want to tell, because it's I think it's super important to kind of visualize, close your eyes and visualize what you want to do. And the reason I say that is because when I'm out in the field, if I'm not visualizing those, I may miss something, you know, because, and later on when I'm coming and on the editing table, I realize, okay, you know what, how did I miss this? So it would have been nice if I had a sequence like this or a sequence like that. So I think, like you said, it's the key is to visualize the story, you know. So when you're out there, you know, like a habitat shot, right? I mean, for these days, people mostly shoot for Instagram and Facebook, so everybody's just zoomed in all the time. It's kind of boring after a point.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's knowing where your delivery is going. You know, why are you filming it? Because so much of the time, I've heard this before. I've heard people say to me, you know, I've got this footage of, you know, this particular animal. Do you think I can sell it somewhere? I say, oh, well, what's it doing? And how many different shots have you got? And they say, oh, it's just this one shot. And I'll say, you know, you can't tell a story with one shot. That's the whole point of sequences. And as you say, if you've got one focal length and you're not understanding the need for, you know, changing focal length, although that doesn't mean you need an expensive camera or big lenses.
Yeah, too.
It's building that story with sequencing, different focal lengths, building, establishing shots so you can see where you're at. People can understand it. Jaya Prakash, where can people find out more about what you're doing? Where can they find you online?
Well, they can find me on my website, which is jayaprakashbhojan.com. Lately, I've been more active on my Instagram, which is, again, Jayaprakash Bhojan. But if you want to look at all the cool videos we've been doing, you can look up for JD, which is J for Jack, D for Delta, Wild Productions on okay. YouTube. So we have a lot of cool videos there, and we have a lot of videos coming soon as well.
That's fantastic. Well, what I'll do is I'll make sure I put links to all of those on our the website page, so masterwildlifefilmmaking.com. There'll be your episode page there with a bio and those links on there as well. So anyone listening can just go straight there and click on it and get to find where you're at. So just lastly, Jayaprakash, what do you have coming up? I know you're going September, you're going back to Borneo. Any other filmmaking that you've got lined up?
Well, we working on two upcoming stories. One is on illegal wildlife trade here in Southeast Asia. It's a documentary I'm working on with WWF. And we have a few other stories we're working on, still working on the storyboard and stuff like that on some of the wetlands that we have over here. The local government has done a tremendous job fighting for these places to conserve them. So that's another story. Few projects in the pipeline with National Geographic Asia. So I'm not supposed to talk about them right now, but probably going to be hosting some photographers from other countries soon here in Singapore to do some stories.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, other than that, I have a few of my other passion projects lined up. So seems to be a good year. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it too. I can't wait to see what you're producing, Jayaprakash. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be on the podcast. And I think it's wonderful you've made this transition. Actually, I should just ask you, are you now 100% photography, or what's the percentage between videography?
probably 90% videography, 10% photography. I mean, once a photographer, I guess you're always a photographer. Yeah. because a lot of times out in the field, when there's something seriously happening, sometimes I have this conflict in my head, you know, maybe I should just snap two shots as well, you know, even though you can take some nice screen grabs with all these high quality equipment, but there's this little bit in me which tells me maybe take this one picture before you do videos, you know.
So. Yeah, I was wondering that. That must be, yeah, I can see. You know, it's always hard when you're on a shoot for a production to remember to do production stills for marketing. And now, of course, it really helps that we can take screen grabs.
Yeah,
because a lot of the time it's forgotten, but that's fantastic. Well, I'm so glad you're part of the wildlife filmmaking family now, and look forward to see what comes out in the future on your YouTube channel and elsewhere. Thanks so much, Jayaprakash.
Thank you, Jake. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for finding me on Instagram. And thanks again for having me as your guest. I appreciate it.
If you have enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please consider leaving a rating and a comment. And subscribe if you haven't already done so from wherever you get your favorite podcasts from. The ratings really help rank the podcast and get more people to find it. Also, if you know someone who is into wildlife filmmaking, or maybe they're a nature photographer and they're looking to transition and they aren't listening to the podcast currently, please tell them about it. Word of mouth is the best way for me to build my listeners for this podcast. I would very much appreciate it. And also, if you are looking to break into the wildlife filmmaking industry and you're just looking for help, you're looking for answers for burning questions that you have, then please consider looking at my Master Wildlife Filmmaking Mentoring group and mentorship program. You can find that at jakewillers.com, and just click on the mentoring tab or learn more tab where it says it on just the homepage there. You can find it very, very easily. And then lastly, if you want to help support this podcast, the best way you can do it, other than just telling other people about the podcast, is to go to our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/MWFP. That's patreon.com/MWFP. And there you can get all sorts of bonus content. We have extracts from podcasts that didn't make it to these episodes because they went on so long, because I didn't want to stop talking with our guests. So we put the extra content there. There are catch-up conversations with previous guests, finding out what they've been doing since I last spoke to them, and so much more of the behind the scenes. Please consider taking a look. That is the best way to sponsor this podcast and get more episodes in the future. Until next time, I'll see you later.